Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 30th of September. And we speak this hour with the author of Kluge. Kluge is a slang word, which means a clumsy or inelegant solution to a problem. The full book's title is Kluge, the Haphazard Construction of the Human Mind. And our guest is Professor Gary Marcus, professor of psychology at New York University, director of the NYU Infant Language Learning Center, author of Birth of the Mind, and editor of the Norton Psychology Reader. He's been a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford, has written for the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, Newsday, and the Los Angeles Times. And he argues, among other things, that the mind is not an elegantly designed organ, but rather a kluge, a clumsy, cobbled-together contraption. And the book is fundamentally a new way of looking at the mind. He says, think duct tape, not supercomputer. It sheds light on some of the most mysterious aspects of human nature. If people were the product of some intelligent, compassionate designer, our thoughts would be rational, our logic impeccable, our memory robust, and our recollections reliable. He joins us this hour, and it should be an interesting and rather fun conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us, if you want to join us on computer, then you go to talk@wpr.org. Professor Gary Marcus, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
And thanks for having me.
Well, you know, we've heard so much about the mind being this fabulous instrument, elegantly designed organ, can do phenomenal things. You bring it down a notch, don't you?
Yeah, well, the economists all thought the mind was a rational entity, and look where that got us. I think there's a myth in economics and certain parts of psychology that the mind is rationally constructed, that we could capture everything that human beings do in a nice equation. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that evolution's a pretty clumsy process. Mm-hmm. I once had the honor of getting to speak to Francis Crick for about 5 minutes. I told him my favorite quote of his, and he came back with one which was even better, which is, he said, in physics we have laws, and he was a physicist before he was a great biologist. He said, in physics we have laws, in biology we have gadgets. And the point of that is that physics might have a few simple principles that govern everything that happens, but biology is just a bunch of things that got thrown together over time by a blind watchmaker, or really by a blind process. And so sometimes it's clumsy around the edges, and it doesn't necessarily make sense from first principle.
Mm-hmm. Let's start with one of the essential areas of human experience, and that's memory. And you talk about the fact that you've lost your keys and can't find your car and things that happen to all of us. We should have better memories. What happened there?
Well, I think that what human beings do with our memories is very different from what a lot of creatures that came before us do. And you have to remember there's an unbroken line between us and bacteria, right? I mean, your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-whatever-it-is-ancestors were bacteria. So, only those creatures that survived managed to pass along their genes. And memory, for a lot of creatures, I think, was a much less precise affair than it is for us. So many creatures, what they needed to remember was something like, there's more food up the mountain than down the mountain. So they could just remember things in general. They could remember quantitative tendencies. But we really have to remember a lot of specific information. So when you try to remember where your keys are, you might get a sort of statistical summary from your mind. It might say, well, usually I put my keys on the ledge. And, you know, sometimes I put them next to my bed. But what you really want to know is not where you usually put your keys. You want to know where you put them now.
Exactly.
And so the sort of statistical function of the brain is at odds with the specific bit of information you need. The parking space thing is even more remarkable, because what happens there is you remember all the places where you parked your car, and they kind of interfere with one another. So if you park in the same lot every day, it's really hard to remember anything more than I'm in that lot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, your brain actually still holds on to a memory from where you parked last week and yesterday and so forth, and they all kind of blend together, which when you reflect on it is incredibly stupid. It's like something Seinfeld would talk about. It actually had an episode of Getting Lost in a Garage. The reason it's like something Seinfeld would talk about is what the brain is doing is it's giving you memories that you absolutely don't need anymore. You don't need to know where your car was last week. But we don't have the level of control over our memories that computers do. So a computer could erase a memory once you don't need it anymore, right? Once you took your car out of the space that it was in last week, that bit of information is of no use to you whatsoever, but it's still there. It clutters up your mind, and then when you want to remember where you parked today, the two things can interfere with one another.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that something? And does it get worse as we get older?
It does get worse. I mean, for a certain time, it actually gets better. So we learn a lot of tricks to cope with our memory, and newborns don't know any of those tricks. They have sort of relatively well-developed memories, but they don't have any tricks for, like, knowing what they remember well and not. And as we get better and older, we can learn, well, these kinds of things are hard to remember, and those other kinds of things are easy to remember. So we get a little bit better. The wiring gets better up to a point. But by the time you're my age, which is near 40, things are already sadly on the decline.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the problem that we have with memory is not storing things. It's really getting the stuff back out again, because
right.
We have this fundamental problem with interference, with, you know, was it this thing or this other thing that I'm trying to get at? And so we have this blurring together.
Right. What happens? This happens to me all the time, and I know people it doesn't happen for, so why does it happen to me and not to them? We have a woman on who can remember seriously every book she's ever read. She remembers the plot. She remembers the characters. She remembers the authors. She can recommend books for people who are 5 and people who are 55 and of all genres. And I have a heck of a hard time, not that I didn't like your book, but 6 days from now when somebody says, oh, who is that guy? I'll say, I'll have to look up the name of the book because I won't be, and I hate to admit this, I won't be able to remember it. That's stupid. I've already looked at the book. We've talked about the book, for heaven's sake. All that information should be stored somewhere in the mind.
And it probably is, but you'd need, like, the right trigger. So, like, my name is Gary Marcus, and if somebody said it began with an M, that might make it easier for you to remember
right.
the name M, Marcus, right? It's in there, but it's hard to get it out. Now, your person that you mentioned, why does she have better memory for this? Different possible reasons. One is she may just spend more time thinking about books. So I remember lots of facts about baseball from when I was a kid because I spent a lot of time studying those facts. Another thing is that she may, when she learns something, spend a bit more effort trying to encode it so that she can remember it better. So you could say, how am I going to remember this guy, Gary Marcus's name? Well, there was Marcus Aurelius, and, you know, I'll make up a story about how he connects us all the way back to the Roman mind. And then, you know, you build a little story, and that might make it better.
It's interesting you mentioned baseball statistics, because I can't tell you how many conversations I've heard with people remembering every single play of a game that happened 20 years ago and who was at bat and how many strikes there were and how many balls there were and where they advanced. And it is intricate knowledge. And I keep thinking, how the heck can you remember this? It's not life and death.
It's you know, it's mostly a matter of interest. It's also like, the more you know about a game, for example, the better you're going to be able to remember things because you're going to connect it to stuff. So a chess master, for example, can replay a game they just played because every move really means something to them. They know how it connects to a kind of literature, a tradition. And the same thing happens with a real fanatic baseball player. I mean, like the pitchers that were actually in these games. I saw an interview with Bob Feller recently, and he remembered, you know, like his first World Series game. He remembered pretty much every pitch. It was so meaningful. To him, he probably rehearsed it, thought about it again and again, came back to it. You know, I threw that guy a slider. Maybe I should have thrown him a fastball, and then I could have had a no-hitter instead, you know. So if you go back to things and practice them, think about how they relate to other things, that's going to help, too. So we're not completely at a loss when it comes to memory, but a lot of this could have been much easier if it had just been organized the way computer memory works. So computers don't need to rehearse things over and over again. They don't need these tricks. They just store something, and it stays there forever.
Mm-hmm.
Everything has a particular location. They just go to the location where that information is. It would have been a much more efficient system. We wouldn't have needed all of these little tricks and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But evolution just didn't figure that trick out. It took an engineer in the 1920s to figure out how to do that.
Well, through evolution, you write about computers and how they can store so much information. Through evolution, will our memories, because we need for them to be, we have in years past too, we need for them to be fairly strong. We have to remember what's happened, how we got where we got, you know, what created problems, what are the solutions to problems, all of that. The world depends on our memories.
So that brings me to one of the central metaphors of the book, which is the idea that what evolution does is it climbs mountains. People often talk about evolution as if it climbed a single mountain, if evolution was a hill climber and it would get you to the top of the mountain. But really, there's a kind of landscape of evolution, and that landscape includes many peaks. And the thing about evolution is it only takes small steps most often. And when you take small steps, you sort of go up but never down, you can wind up at the top of a mountain, but a mountain that's very much shorter than the tallest mountain. So if you think about, like, the Himalayas or something like that, you know, there are many, many jagged peaks. And the landscape of evolution is sorted that way because of complexities about how genes work and so forth. And so what's happened is we have the best version of what we have, which I call context-dependent memory. But we don't have the way that computers work, which I call location-addressable memory. And it's very unlikely that we're going to be able to skip between those mountains unless we use some kind of modern technology to do it. On its own, like, there's nothing that would be a little bit better than our memory system. There's only something that would be very different. And evolution tends to stick with what it's already got rather than moving off to something that's very different.
So, oh, that's interesting.
So our memory's probably not going to change substantially unless we bring in some kind of brain chip or something like that, which may well happen.
And what about looking at memory and other animals? Let's take one that's very similar to us, chimpanzees.
Mm-hmm. There's no reason to think that their memory is very different from ours. They can do some memory tasks even better than we can. But in general, their memories seem to work along the same principles as ours. So one of those principles is that the context in which you learn something matters. And that seems to be true for chimps as much as it does for us. A lot of the structure of our brain is really pretty similar if you look at, say, any other mammal. So not just chimpanzees, but even rats, for example, are going to have memories that work in fairly similar ways. The biggest difference is that we can use language as a way to structure our memory. So that gives us an edge for learning, say, complex information about, you know, politics or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just remembering, like, where you saw the food last, we're not particularly any better than other species. And there's some birds that are actually much better than us.
Hmm. You talk about the mind having to adapt to our complex world. Its well-developed penchant for short-term satisfactions can be literally fatal. And I want to talk about those short-term satisfactions. Those seem to guide us more and more these days.
Well, there was an article about my governor just yesterday, my former governor, Elliot Spitzer, 6 months later. He's a man who lost his whole career over short-term satisfaction.
Yeah, isn't that something? And a lot of politicians do.
Mm-hmm.
So you talk about it being fatal, which it can be. What's going on with that?
Well, this is a perfect example of a kludge. So to remind your listeners, a kludge is a kind of clumsy solution to a problem. It's like duct tape and rubber bands. It gets the job done, but not very well. So what's going on there is we have a kind of old brain. Freud was, I think, close to the mark here, not exactly on the mark, but we have an old set of systems that really are about short-term survival. And then we have a newer set of systems that can be more rational, can deliberate, can make long-term plans and so forth. But the thing is that the old system is still sort of more deeply entrenched in the brain, and so usually it has first go at the steering wheel. The older system has to find ways to trick the newer system has to find ways to trick the older system into doing what it wants. Other things being equal, by default, if you're not really focused, the old system's going to take over. And so if you're tired, if you're drunk, if you're distracted, you're going to wind up doing the things that your older system wants you to do.
Mm-hmm. Why would you go the direction of being not necessarily tired, but drunk or on drugs or going into rages or doing other things that would limit your capacity for rational action?
And a lot of those things give us pleasure in the short term. Alcohol is a good example of this, right? It gives people short-term pleasure. It actually is a depressive chemical, and may lead people to be more depressed in the long term, but people tend to make short-term decisions. They like the short-term reward. My favorite example of this is actually television. So television, why do people watch it? It's because there's relatively low energy invested. You can just sit there on the couch, and it feels good right away. Now, the truth is it doesn't feel that good, and after you've watched 4 hours, you may feel like you've wasted your time. In fact, you have. And studies show that people that watch a little bit of television, choose judiciously, are actually happier than people that watch a lot of television.
Hmm.
But it's just very tempting to sit there, and, you know, you get the short-term rewards of the flashing lights and the insight into other people's lives and, you know, all this kind of stuff, even though it doesn't really make any difference in the end.
Does it make any difference what you're watching, be it a soap opera or a baseball game or a political debate?
I suspect that it makes some difference. So if you're watching some sitcom, there's nothing to take away. If you're watching the debates and you really care about politics, then you may, you know, learn some information that you can use, at least so that you can feel good that you've made the right choice, which is another sort of clumsy thing about the human mind, is we're not really very rational thinkers. We're more like thinkers that want to find things that make sense to us and make us feel good. So people walk away, they watch the same debate, and they're like, well, my guy won, your guy, you know, he's an idiot. But the right. thing is, people on both sides think that, and they can't all be right.
Let's welcome phone calls. I think we're going to have many of them taking us in extremely interesting directions. Gary Marcus, as in Marcus Aurelius, is our guest this hour, so you'll remember his name. Now I will always remember his name. His book is Kluge, The Haphazard Construction of the Human Mind. Kluge is a clumsy or inelegant solution to a problem. And Gary is professor of psychology at New York University and director of the NYU Infant Language Learning Center, author of Birth of the Mind, and editor of the Norton Psychology Reader. He's been a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford and has written for the New York Times, Philadelphia Inquirer, Newsday, the LA Times, and many other publications. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Did I give you the number? I can't remember. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I just want to remind you during this political season, and the weeks are going by here, that we're having a special broadcast at Marquette University. It will be a live radio broadcast featuring representatives of the presidential campaigns. Mike Uche will be joining us. Students from Marquette will be joining us. And we're inviting you to come to the Marquette University Alumni Memorial Union. And this is going to be a free event. We're just asking you to let us know that you will be there. It's Thursday from October 30th, and we'll broadcast our full 2 hours. It should be a great deal of fun and a chance for all of us to talk about this race, which will only be a few days away. We'll be having a reception following the broadcast from 11 to 11:30, and when we went to Iowa, we said we'll bring chocolate cake, and oh, did we have chocolate cake. It was a great trip, and so we're winding it up close to a year later at Marquette. So call this number to say, yes, I'd like to be there, and we'd enjoy meeting you. 414-227-2047, 414-227-2047, and ask for Katie Mattson. All right, let's go to phone calls. Our lines are jammed here. We start with Ken from Milton. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I wonder what the explanation is for it taking longer to recall things as you get older. I know you just talked about your brain going back to a younger time, or at 30 it would be right there. But now, if you're trying to recall something, it'll take a minute or two and be very embarrassing sometimes.
I think there are two different reasons for that. One's sort of more psychological and one's more biological. The psychological one is you just have more things to sift through as you get older. And so, as I mentioned, one of the problems with it, memory is interference. You have several different competing memories, and the more you have, the more likely you are to have a mistake or not feel confident that you've got the answer right. So part of it is you've just got more stuff in there to sort out. The other problem is kind of a hardware problem, a biological problem, that the machinery of neurons and so forth is fragile, and it tends to break down just like any part of the body. So evolution isn't an actual person, but if you were going to anthropomorphize, you'd say that evolution really cares about how well the body works before we reproduce and take care of our children. There's less effect on natural selection for what happens afterwards, and the parts tend to break down just like they will in a car. And unfortunately, that happens to our brains as well as our bodies.
Hmm. And yet, when you look at, and you hear this time and time again, and I remember in my dad's last days, we would spend hours talking about his life. And his memory, he didn't really lose his memory very much. He'd remember short-term was gone. He couldn't remember names. But when it came to the intricacies and the emotions of the Depression and of flipping hamburgers and World War II and where he was, what ship he was on, he remembered all the names and the locations of where they were, and then the intricacies of business dealings in the sugar business, which just astounded me. Where was he going with all of that, and why was he remembering all of that?
I don't know. I don't really know the answer to that. I mean, it's a common phenomenon that people will remember things from a much earlier time better than recent things, especially as they get older. I don't really know the exact mechanisms for it. Probably part of it is that those are memories that are very important to him, that he's, again, that he's rehearsed, he's thought about a number of times. There may also be some biological decay on the short-term memory system. So short-term memory and long-term memory seem to work on different kinds of principles and use different parts of the brain. And so the short-term stuff may in some way be more vulnerable.
And maybe for some reason we take some of those to what we know is an approaching death?
Yeah, I mean, it's a common phenomenon. I don't really know.
Yeah.
There are many things about psychology I can speak to, but that one I don't really know the answer.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ken, very much for the call. Let's go to Jim from Milwaukee next. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I was born with the middle name of Coolidge in a Republican family, and I'm now the liberal wing of the Democratic Party because over the years, have accepted things that I was uncomfortable with and didn't particularly want to hear, but I accepted them and looked into them. And I've got a relative who is a smart guy, and he was an engineer. But, for example, we were having a discussion, and I said, well, you know, you wouldn't raise your kids that they would do anything they wanted without any consequences, and yet that's the way the Republicans have run the regulatory agencies for 8 years. And he, agreed with me, but when all is said and done, you could tell him that the sun rises in the east. He'd agree that the sun rises in the east, and by the end of the discussion, he would be saying that the sun doesn't rise in the east. And so the problem is, how do you talk to somebody that you can't tell anything?
I think it's difficult. I mean, you can try to sort of establish ground rules up in the front, but the thing is that our brains really aren't set up to be rational. We can learn to be rational. We can learn to follow the rules of argument, but not everybody does it. It's not built into our minds that we're all going to follow the rules of debate and follow the laws of logic. That's actually something that we have to learn. It doesn't come natural for the human mind. And people differ in how interested they are in trying to do that. There's a variable that we call need for cognition, which is how interested people are in sort of trying to get to the bottom of things, and not everybody is. And then it's the case that everybody, not just their friends, we all think our friends are dumber than we are, but everybody, your professor included, are vulnerable to these kinds of mistakes where we're, for example, subject to what's called confirmation bias. And that means that we notice evidence that favors our theories. We don't necessarily notice as well evidence that goes against our theories.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, another thing you can do is to be aware of that, but it's easier to fix yourself than to fix other people in this regard. So, I think that you can make yourself into a better human being by, for example, always trying to consider anything that's important from multiple perspectives. So instead of taking the first hypothesis that comes to you and saying, that makes sense to me, which is what we tend to do, consider the opposite hypothesis and say, well, how would somebody argue for that? What would the arguments be there? And, I mean, especially if you're a scientist, but I think even if you're an ordinary citizen, can be extremely valuable to think about alternative hypotheses. And not just when you're arguing with someone else, but like if you're making a decision about whether to buy a house or a car or something like that, some substantial decision. Paying attention to alternative hypotheses doesn't come naturally to us, but
no.
It's something that we can learn. Now, how you get your friends to do that's another story. I would actually like, on that note, though, to have the educational system work a bit on that more. So right now, children spend most of their time memorizing things. If I were king for a day, I would revamp the curriculum so that part of what children learned about was how the brain works and how it doesn't work, how, you know, we make the kinds of mistakes that I talk about in the book, Glute. Give children practical education and sort of the limits of the human mind and how to work around them. And there's some evidence that that would actually be helpful. So teaching children philosophy, teaching like 10-year-olds philosophy seems to actually have some long-term effective consequences.
And I would think teaching debate and engaging in debate would do the same.
Yeah, I mean, making debate mandatory might not be a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there was a time when maybe it was.
Yeah. It's very hard to do this, isn't it? Because it's not just an intellectual engagement you're on. It's also emotional.
That's right. I mean, part of the clue here is that the intellectual stuff is sort of too tapped into the emotional stuff. So part of the way we reason, there's another phenomenon called motivated reasoning. The motivation is it's typically that we want to feel like we've made the right choices. And so if you see something that, let's say you're a Democrat, as I am, and you hear something that makes you a little bit suspicious about Palin, well, then you're going to pursue that. You're going to find out everything you can about what's wrong with Palin.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody starts complaining about Biden, you might not pay as much attention to it. You might not, you know, follow it to the last line in the same way. So how hard we reason about something, how much we really engage our brains in being rational and gathering fair evidence and so forth, is really very intimately tied to happiness. I mean, like anything else, right? We have motivational systems that are about keeping ourselves happy, keeping us away from pain. And those actually govern how much we use the rational parts of our brain.
Anything else, Jim?
No, it's just very interesting. Because it's very frustrating to deal with people that you can't tell anything to.
No, absolutely. I've been spending some of my time writing op-eds lately. and I feel your pain.
Thanks, Jim.
Okay, bye-bye.
Let's go to Tom from Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hello. I'm glad the last caller, we're kind of getting away from the memory part of this into more processing of reality, because I'm a college graduate, I'm a pharmacist, and the vast majority of my training was through memorizing drugs and all that, but they say that college is to teach you how to think, but it's really gotten away from that. It's more of a strategy to memorize things, and it's going to come back to haunt us in many things. My latest thing I'm working in as an environmentalist is the whole environmental aspects of things and of oil. And the latest writers are going more into the psychology of the brain, into what the guest is talking about. And I wanted the guest to expound upon what Carl Jung said, that humans can handle only so much reality. And a more recent psychologist is Leon Festinger that talked about cognitive dissonance, that people can't handle two conflicting realities, even though one of them is likely wrong, and people will come up with fanciful ideas to they can't handle that dissonance, that uncomfortableness of having those two different realities. And why this is critically important right now is because we've gambled with oil. And we put ourselves into a box that is going to result in horrific results because we can't think critically. Now, as I call it, the trifecta from hell with this gambling is we've got a population of 6.5 billion people, which largely came out of the Green Revolution, which came from oil and natural gas for fertilizers and pesticides. And along with the oil, we obviously got global warming. And now the third part of the trifecta is peak oil. People refuse to believe that we can continually draw oil out of the earth, that it's going to keep coming out at 85 million barrels a day. And it's just we're going to go into depletion, and when that oil goes into depletion, everything is going to fall apart if we don't act on it right now. So
I certainly agree with you about your concerns about the environment. I'm slightly more optimistic than you are. First of all, I will give you my favorite line that fits with what you said in the first part, which is from A Few Good Men, written by Aaron Sorkin and delivered by Jack Nicholson, which is, you can't handle the truth. And it's true. A lot of the time, people can't handle the truth. And the mechanisms I'm talking about, motivated reasoning and so forth, means that, like, we want to get to a comfortable place. And when we reason, we don't always reason through to the final bottom line. The reason I'm a little bit more optimistic, though, is there is the possibility of cultural change, and I think this is a place where we are actually seeing it. So in my lifetime, for example, smoking has gone from being basically pretty cool to being not so good and not allowed in lots of restaurants. Drunk driving is the same way. It went from being sort of a giggle and a laugh to being something that's pretty much frowned upon. And I think that, in part because of Al Gore and in part because of a lot of other fine people, the environment really is getting on the radar. So I'm cautiously optimistic that people will pay more attention to these things. Government decisions are more complicated than individual decisions. I mean, you can talk about, you know, the interest of individual people in the government and whether the government is appropriately constituted and stuff like that. So I think there are legitimate concerns about, you know, whether the interests of the people in government are right. But I think at least the populace as a whole is kind of getting it on that issue, and I'm heartened.
Tell us, Gary, you write early in the book that kludges can give us clues into how we can improve ourselves.
Mm-hmm. How can they do that?
Uh-huh.
Well, one of them I already talked about, which is this idea of alternative hypotheses.
Right.
If you recognize that the way the brain works is not to, by default, to balance competing hypotheses like the scales of justice, but really just to consider one hypothesis, And if you recognize that that leads you into trouble, then you can push yourself towards making it a habit of thinking about alternative hypotheses. And that's, in fact, what graduate school is really about, is teaching students to say, well, yeah, you think your theory explains the data, but maybe somebody else could explain those data in a different way, getting mm-hmm. people in the habit of doing that. That's one of the best things we can do. Another thing is you can recognize some of the limits in the structure of the mind. So I talked about this conflict between short-term and long-term systems. So you can try to find ways to work around that. One thing, a simple thing you can do is you can say, well, if I make this decision now, am I going to feel good about it tomorrow or next week? So I feel good about eating this chocolate cake now, but maybe next week I'm going to think, oh, God, now I'm going to have to spend 3 hours in the gym instead of two. Or on a more global scale, you can say, yeah, it feels great to drive to the ski slopes, but what am I doing to the environment? Am I, you know, when I look back on this 10 years from now, am I going to think I was just wasting a lot of gas for frivolous things? So thinking about how your future self will think about something, getting yourself in the habit of doing that is really important. And habits, again, are extremely important because most of what the older parts of the brain do is reflexes and habits. And so you have to train yourself to do things automatically, to think about the alternative hypotheses, to think about your future self. Here's one last example that rests, again, on this analysis of short-term versus long-term. If you want to change something about yourself, the trick is to actually build a habit. So if you start with some abstract goal, like I want to save gasoline or something like that, it's all well and good, but when it comes down to it and you're making a snap decision, should I go to the movies now or whatever, you may not actually think about that long-term goal because, as I said, the short-term system is holding the steering wheel. Take another example. If you want to cut down on desserts that you're eating, just saying I want to lose weight is not very specific. You know, that's what the deliberative rational system says. But the short-term system is like, I see the cake. So what you have to do is you have to trick the short-term system and say, like, whenever I see chocolate cake, I'm going to sit on my hands. And if you practice that enough times, you'll actually do it and maybe eat a couple fewer chocolate cakes.
Oh, darn. I'm afraid that hasn't done me any good. I just want chocolate cake now after you describe that.
Well, there is a separate problem. It's the famous don't think of pink elephants problem.
You know, I was thinking about, as you were talking about alternative hypotheses and how that may serve us well in some areas of life and may not. There was an interesting piece you probably saw in the New York Times Magazine section last week or the week before that looked at the way Senator Obama was teaching race and the law and constitutional law at the University of Chicago. And I guess he is known for, and he's gotten in trouble on the campaign trail for this, for being able to see alternative hypotheses. And his students, one after another, would say, we didn't really know where he stood on these issues because he was able to see all sides of an issue and present them. Don't forget to think about this. Don't forget to think about that. And then I'm wondering, isn't this maybe what has gotten him, he's not in a whole lot of trouble right now, but gotten him in some trouble because people are saying he's not a fighter, he can't thank people for their credit, he can't be bipartisan enough, you don't win elections this way, you can't consider alternative hypotheses, you need one, and this is the way we're going.
Well, I mean, I tend to think that his way is the right way to go, although I think one needs to ultimately be decisive. So I think the trick is you have to open yourself to all sides. You have to say, these guys on the other side, they're probably not all stupid. And maybe some of the people who are chanting the party line are stupid, but some of the people on the other side probably have a point. What is their point, and how can I fit my point with their point and come up with something better? And so, I mean, ultimately, I think you need that kind of mind to actually cross the aisle, as McCain kept saying, and not actually doing. In order to cross the aisle, you really have to understand where the people on the other side of the aisle are coming from, and I think he's good at that. What we need to find out is whether, when the chips are down, he can actually make a choice. And I don't know if we have enough data on that. I am convinced, you know, for a bunch of different reasons, that he's my candidate, but I think that's what individual voters have to decide. I think it's clear that he has a really good grasp of the issues. He's a very quick study. He can understand the nuances. And whether he can make decisions or not, you know, people have to decide that. At the opposite end is McCain, who seems to make decisions by the seat of his pants. I actually wrote something in the Huffington Post about that yesterday, stealing a title from Kenny Rogers. I called it The Gambler. And I think if you look at McCain, he's very quick to make decisions. He's very slow to think about alternative hypotheses. And so, like, he met Palin. He thought she was great. And he didn't, you know, do the usual kind of vetting that one ought to do in the modern age. And now he's stuck with this embarrassing candidate. And people in his own party are saying, you know, I hope she'll step down.
I wonder what he's going to do about her. It's hard to imagine what he's going to do about her.
I mean, I don't know if you read a singer named Kathleen Parker's piece in the National Review over the weekend.
But I heard about it, but I need to read it, yeah.
The bottom line is what he really needs is for her to step down and say, I need to take care of my child.
Hmm.
He can't really push her out. I mean, he can quietly push her out, but he can't officially push her out because then that shows that he made a bad decision and he doesn't want to do that. So he's a little bit stuck. I think the Republican Party would really be better off if she did step down. The nation would also be better off. That's a different story.
Thanks, Tom, very much for your call. And let us go to... Let's go to an email. This is a very interesting topic. Could you please talk about the connection between emotions and learning and memory?
What can I say about that? First thing I'd say is that emotional memories tend to be more vivid. They're not necessarily more accurate. So, like, people think that they remember everything that happened on 9/11 very accurately because it's such an emotional thing. But emotions seem to actually increase people's confidence that they remember. But if you look at the actual data, so a lot of people went out and collected reports of how well people remembered 9/11. Emotional memory isn't necessarily more accurate. It's just more deeply felt, but that doesn't guarantee a translation into greater accuracy. Now, emotions themselves can be cues to memory. So, for example, when you're depressed, you think about more depressing things. So, you know, if you had a lot of money in the market yesterday, you would feel pretty bad about it. And that might make you think about some other bad things, like fights you had at work recently. And that might make you think about fights you had with your wife. The next thing you know, you're drinking whiskey and listening to
breakups. Oh, my
gosh. So, memory, and this is a real flaw in the mind, too, that you get into these sort of feedback cycles driven by emotion.
Mm-hmm.
So emotion certainly can serve as a cue to memory. I'm not sure it really makes memory more accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, you should think about chocolate cake and going to the beach and not end on such a down note.
Exactly. Go ahead and eat the chocolate cake, right?
Just once I say it's okay, it'll make sense.
Right. Okay. Let's go to David from Ironwood. Hi, David.
Oh, a lot of good points you people brought. Someone was mentioning earlier about remembering things when you're old, days gone by. I recently took care of a person that she couldn't remember what happened an hour ago, but she could recall her early childhood days and early 20s and stuff. The doctor said there's a chemical involved in making short-term memories, and doesn't get into short-term memory, never gets into long-term memory, and therefore, if your brain quits making this chemical, a lot of older people have less of it. That's why that is that. But I called for the fact that Madison Avenue is a good example. The early commercials were rational, but then they found out it was a lot better appealing to the emotions to sell products. And
yeah,
this
they
is
have switched
in politics and everything. Instead of appealing to people's rationality, you have rational people figuring out that, oh, yeah, if we hit the emotional things, we get people to do this. But in the long term, it's going to be bad for the stock market crash and all this stuff that's happening, I think, is because too many people are going by their guts instead of rational thinking.
I mean, I totally agree with you there. I think there's been a slight shift in that half-naked girls are no longer necessarily the advertising emotional element of choice. Now we have, you know, things where males bond with one another and so forth, but they're all about having some kind of emotional feeling. And the same is true in political advertising. And the most famous political advertisement in recent memory, depends how recent your memory is, I guess, it would be the Willie Horton advertisement that torpedoed Dukakis, where, you know, you had this strong emotional image of this released prisoner who was wreaking havoc and so forth. There's no doubt about it. We respond more quickly to the emotional stuff than the rational stuff. And we're a society that's sort of set up to do that. We're constantly bombarded with emotional images, and the schools don't do enough to teach people to be good consumers and to be careful, reflective consumers.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Let's spend just a few minutes on language before we go back to our phone calls and take a quick pause. You do write in the book about how English language is just crazy in some ways. You wonder how we came up with with sing, sang, sung, and other kinds of words that just don't make a whole lot of sense. Why is that, and will we ever change that?
Well, language is like the species itself. It kind of evolves through natural selection, and it's not designed in advance. So if you're going to design a language in advance, you might make it more like computer languages, which are much more precise, or mathematical languages. But what really happens is there's just a bunch of accidents. A lot of the accidents happen because children misunderstand things. And one child's error becomes the next generation's proper language. And so there's all this constant shifting. A child misparses something that they hear. They think that a verb is a suffix, and that thing becomes a suffix instead of a freestanding verb. That's one issue. Another issue is that because our memories are imprecise, we aren't able to represent a series of words, sentences, in unambiguous fashion. So if I say a sentence to you like, the spy shot the cop with a revolver, you may think, okay, the spy used the revolver to shoot the cop, but it could mean the opposite. It could mean that there was a cop with a revolver and a cop with a nightstick.
Oh,
the spy thought, you know, I better take care of the guy with the gun before I go after the other guy. So language is filled with these kinds of ambiguities, and it would be very easy to avoid that problem with a very simple trick, which is parentheses, which is what mathematics does. So, you know, parentheses 3 times 4, right parentheses plus 2 is different from 3 times parentheses 4 plus 2, right parentheses, right? Mm-hmm. Language doesn't have that, and I think that actually relates to the weaknesses of our memory. You can't build a brain that would be able to keep track of those things using the kind of memory system that we have. So language is kind of a clumsy accommodation to the fact that our memories are sort of misstructured in the first place.
Let's pause. We'll return our guest, the author of Kluge, The Haphazard Construction of the Human Mind. Gary Marcus is our guest, and Gary is a professor of psychology at NYU, director of the NYU Infant Language Learning Center, author of The Birth of the Mind, and editor of the Norton Psychology Reader, and he's written for a number of publications around the country. Back to you momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls now, and let us go to Dave from Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. Two comments. I'm being a Democrat, I'm at times in awe of the way that the Republicans are able to manipulate words to sound like something when they're actually something else. I want to give your guest comments on how they've been able to manipulate the media with this fair and balanced thing, making it seem. So what we end up with is a he said, she said, and then we're left hanging because the media is afraid. You know, and the media should come in and say, and this is what he said, this is what she said, this is what we found, this is. After investigating, this is what we found. But they're so afraid of coming up with what might be considered liberal media that they kind of leave us just hanging, and reasoning skills are absolutely being attacked when we have just two he said, she said things. And hopefully one more comment. When President Bush, before we were going into the war, he would say, two sentences always end to end, and it would always be something about the victims of 9/11, and then the next sentence would start with Saddam Hussein must come down with an. So when he would put these two sentences together, 60% of the nation believed Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. So they were absolutely brilliant the way they were able to make people think that by not actually saying it, but by putting those two sentences together end to end. And I wanted to get your guest comments on that.
Okay.
My comment is, have you been reading my email?
I just
wrote an op-ed, which I've not yet placed, that makes very much those points, and I'll sort of turn it around. So what is the problem with this he said, she said attitude, right? So you're absolutely right. The media is always afraid to sort of call it, right? They just say, well, this is what the Republicans said. Here's our, you know, pundit from the Republicans. Here's our pundit from the Democrats. Well, the problem with that is it licenses everybody to think they're right. So I mentioned earlier, but I'll come back to it, the confirmation bias. You notice evidence that supports your theory. So all you have to do, whatever your theory is, you watch the network news, and you got one guy who's saying a thing that you believe in, and you can ignore the other. Mm-hmm. So everybody listens to the news and becomes more convinced than ever that they're correct, and they just ignore the other guy. In this climate, and it's not just the networks, but also the fact that, like, it's very easy to just pick your favorite blog. You read the Daily Kos if you're on one side, or the National Review if you're on the other, and Coulter if you're on the other side. We've reached this point in society where information is cheap, and it's very easy to find somebody that agrees with you. And that's fatal as a society, because democracy is about voters making decisions, informed decisions, but all people are doing is informing themselves about why they must be right in the first place. And that's because of this confirmation bias. It's easier to notice the evidence that fits your own theory.
Thanks very much for the call. Tiger from Green Bay. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
I'll have a speakerphone just a moment.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Okay, first observation is those of us who think that we have a high need for cognition have a different technical term for those who don't. We call them a slight pain in the keister, but I don't want to confuse the jargon. Anyways, I was going to say, when you talk about being having a younger brain and an older brain, I learned to talk in Texas. I grew up when I was very young, and at 3 and a half, I moved to Wisconsin. And now I speak with a Wisconsin accent, except, as your guest noted, if I'm very tired or if I've had a couple of drinks, I start talking Texas, which is very difficult when I order a Coke with no ice, because they make me repeat "no ice" 3 times until I say "no ice," and then they say, "Oh, that's what you mean." So, anyway, I thought that was a very interesting anecdote that jives a lot with what your guest was saying. I'm so enjoying this show today. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tiger. Thanks for the call.
Thanks for your comment. I just wonder also whether if you're in a room full of Texans, whether that also might make you speak a bit more Texan-like. I had a friend who spoke perfect American English, except when he would speak to his mom, who was British, on the phone, and then suddenly he was back to British, and he wouldn't otherwise do it, couldn't otherwise do it. But because the way that memory cues tie together, hearing the one dialect automatically triggered the other.
Interesting. Huh. Thanks, Tiger, for the call. Let's go to Jeff from Owen. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Just fine.
Good.
I'm really enjoying the conversation. I'm sorry, I kind of came in on the middle of it. But something that your guest said sort of angered me, and it prompted me to call. Earlier, he cited the film A Few Good Men, and the villainous character that Jack Nicholson played and the villainous line that he spoke, "You can't handle the truth." And then he reinforced that and said, that's right, that people can't handle the truth. And I think that's wrong. I think people can choose to ignore the truth, but I think everybody, before they die, come to face the truth. So people can handle the truth. And I don't think that they should be encouraged to believe that they can't. Other than that, I think this is a great conversation.
Thanks for the call. Gary?
Well, I mean, I think it actually varies. So, I mean, because of the way that emotion ties in with sort of rational thought, sometimes people can handle the truth and sometimes they can't. And what do they do when they can't handle the truth? Well, sometimes they make up fiction. So one example is some people who happen more often to be Republican, since we're on a political theme today, have a greater need to believe that the world is just. And people with a greater need to believe, I mean, some people just accept the world is not fair. My seventh grade math teacher used to tell this over and over again. Life is not fair. I guess trying to prepare us for the world. In any case, some people believe that, and some people think that the world is fair. And it turns out, if you do experimental studies, the people that have a higher belief in a just world will sometimes do pretty disturbing things in order to preserve that belief. They will, for example, think that a rape victim, they'll be more likely to think that a rape victim, you know, brought her attackers on by dressing provocatively or something like that. So, I mean, people do interesting things when the truth is disturbing to them, including sort of making up alternative frameworks for why something might be the case in order to preserve some other set of beliefs.
Mm. Thanks very much for the call. We have time for one more phone call, and let's just go to Julian from Ashland. Hi, Julian.
Hi, I'm just wondering why your brain kind of picks upon things that you are around. Like if you go on vacation for a few weeks, you'll come back with a slight accent. Or, or if you move somewhere else, you might lose kind of your mental identity and all of a sudden start picking up the way people talk. That's pretty much it. I just want to hear your guess.
All right, Julian. Thanks.
Well, one of the things that memory does that's actually fairly good, at least in most, not all circumstances, is it tends to emphasize the things that are most recent, because those tend to be the most useful. I mean, think about it, like, what's important in the news now if you're going to read the news? Well, you need to understand, you know, as best you can, nobody can fully understand it, how banking works. So that's sort of at the top of your mental stack of things to know about. And your memory is always sort of compensating for that. It's always trying to get you to think about the things that happened most recently, and so it's sort of reshuffling the memories that you have. That's not a perfect strategy, because sometimes you need to sort of dig deep and remember something that you haven't used, you know, let's say in the last 3 years. That's a little bit hard for the memory system to do that. But what it's essentially trying to do is to keep you in the current game, and that's not such a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the call. Thanks for the hour. It was really interesting. Lots of audience interest in this topic, too, Gary. Thank you.
It was my pleasure. Thanks.
Yeah, our pleasure. Gary Marcus is the author of Kluge, The Haphazard Construction of the Human Mind. And Kluge means a clumsy or inelegant solution to a problem. He's a professor of psychology at New York University and director of the NYU Infant Language Learning Center. We thank him for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, John Treader for on-air production here at our Milwaukee studios, and thanks for all of your calls, everybody. I'm Kathleen Dunn. News coming up. We'll be with you again tomorrow, Wednesday at 9 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.